Good evening, and welcome to tonight's monthly teleconference. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question and answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, press 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. Once your question is asked, your line will be remuted. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. I would now like to turn the conference over to Kelsey Baker, Community Health Intern for the MS Society Greater Northwest Chapter. Kelsey, you may begin.
Thank you all so much for registering for our regional teleconference. Get the 411 on MS disease management and therapeutics. We're so pleased to have you all on the line with us this evening. This teleconference is one of the many free and helpful programs and services available to people living with MS through the National MS Society. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend, or a caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867. Tonight's teleconference will provide an in-depth conversation on how and why you should take charge of your disease. We all know that there is no cure for MS now, but there are many more therapies available today to manage the disease, which may slow it down or help control your symptoms. Our featured speaker this evening is Dr. Levy, neurologist with Kootenai Neurology in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Following this teleconference, you will receive an email or letter if you do not have email, containing additional information about this evening's topic, as well as other programs and services available to you through the National MS Society. I thank you again for being on the call this evening, and would like to hand it off to Dr. Levy. You may begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelsey. My name is Louisa Levy. I'm a neurologist at Kootenai Medical Center in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And just a little bit of background about me. I grew up in Bellingham, Washington, and I did my training in medical school as well as neurology residency at the University of Washington. And I became a neurologist actually because of I worked with a neurologist as a medical student in multiple sclerosis. So I chose to go into neurology because I basically wanted to help MS patients in particular. And I did a fellowship in multiple sclerosis and trained in Seattle at University of Washington with George Kraft, who's a rehab MS doc there, as well as James Bowen, a neurologist at Swedish, and various other neurologists in the area. So I came out to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, because there's no MS docs out here in Idaho. There are some in Spokane, and I really wanted to just be able to help patients. And the National MS Society is basically sponsoring this talk, and our goal is really to help patients in this region understand, I think, from a neurologist's point of view, how do neurologists determine if your drug is working? What are the things that we watch for? And I think if you understand where your neurologist is coming from, it'll allow you to take charge of your own care and actually participate. And so my goal tonight is actually for you to understand how MS is managed, what your options are, and why do you want to treat it versus taking a watch and wait approach, which is what we used to do before the therapies were available. Now we are much more proactive about treating earlier. So, and I'll also basically give a timeline to give a perspective about how MS has really, the field has developed, and now that we have treatments, we have many, many therapies available. And they're really as of 1993, so very, very new. And I'll also go through the stages of MS, the types of MS, because the type of MS that you have completely determines your response to treatment and how aggressive we are, and changes the risk-benefit profile of each medicine. So we don't treat an early MS patient the same as a late-stage MS patient because the risks are different and your response to treatment is different. So all of those factors actually go into how your neurologist is managing your MS. And then we'll talk about disability and how that actually is linked to relapses, how that changes as your MS progresses. We'll talk about the treatment of MS and go through basically the options the injectables, the infusions, the oral drugs, and then chemo agents, and then also new therapies in coming down the pipeline. And then most of all, I want people to understand how do you know that your therapy is working? What are the parameters that we follow? And then hopefully by the end of this talk, you'll have a chance to ask questions if any of that is unclear. So we'll get started right now. Basically, let's start with giving a timeline about where we are with MS. If we go back in time, MS was first described in 1868 by a neurologist named Dr. Charcot, and he's really the founder of neurology. And he noticed basically a pattern in certain patients and described MS for the first time. And it wasn't until 1878 that we discovered myelin for the first time, the substance that actually is attacked by your immune system, and which is what causes MS. And then in the early 1900s, 1919, we discovered that MS patients have markers of MS in their cerebral spinal fluid, and that's where spinal taps became used to diagnose MS. And then in the 1960s was really the first treatment in the form of steroids. We realized that steroids actually can affect the course, can treat relapses. The problems with steroids, though, in the 1960s, even though we used them, steroids don't do anything to change the course of the disease. So what they do is shorten relapses and attacks and speed up recovery, but they don't do anything to get you better in the end. So if you didn't do steroids versus you did choose to do steroids for an attack, you're going to recover just the same and no better if you receive steroids. So steroids are actually used just to manage attacks, to shorten the symptoms so you can get on with your life and then minimize the symptoms. But they actually don't do anything to change the course of the disease, meaning that they don't affect the chances of or decrease the risk of future attacks. They don't reduce disability, and that's why steroids aren't used as a mainstay, except sometimes to bridge between therapies to kind of cover people temporarily until you can get onto a drug that does affect the course of MS, and we call those drugs disease-modifying therapies, or DMTs for short. So, and then in 1981, the development that really revolutionized the way we diagnose MS and monitor MS was really due to the MRI. The MRIs were first used in MS patients in 1981, and since then, it's completely changed how we can detect MS. We can detect it much earlier because most spots on the brain scan are actually silent. And by the time someone is diagnosed with symptoms, they've already got several spots on their brain scan. And we now can actually diagnose that much earlier, and that is important because that means we can start treatment earlier. And we've learned that we can start treatment earlier, and it results in better outcome down the road, and it reduces the disability long-term, pushes back the progression, reduces spots, and then reduces relapses. So really the MRI has been really key in allowing us to treat people earlier. And then with time and more clinical trials, we've developed our first disease-modifying therapies, the actual therapies that changed the course of MS, and that was in 1993 with beta-seron and interferon, that when it came out, they didn't make enough and people had to be on a lottery to get onto the drug. And then since then, we've just kind of exploded in the last 10 years, 15 years, in lots and lots of options for therapy. So, and I wanted to take a step back and actually talk about the types of MS that are known and how that actually affects your treatment. And if you can understand the types of MS and then the disability that results in immune systems attacking your myelin, I think that would be a good baseline to understand in order to understand the treatment. So let's back up and then talk about the types of MS. So the majority of MS affects women, and it used to be 2-to-1 women to men. And over time, it's actually increasing to 4-to-1. In certain regions, women are getting MS and outnumbering men by 4-to-1. And we don't really understand why that is, except that there's some susceptibility that women have that men don't. It could be that something on the Y chromosome that men have is protective, but more likely there's some sort of susceptibility that women have that men don't have. And so it affects young people, typically in their 20s and 30s, is the most common age of diagnosis, but it really could affect adolescents, teenagers, even young children, And the upper end of MS is really diagnosis usually by the time you're 50s or 60s. It's really unusual to diagnose someone in their 70s with MS. And chances are, if you're making a diagnosis in someone who's 70, it's because they had symptoms that they just chose not to go to a neurologist, and they kind of escaped detection because of that. So the most common type of MS is one that affects young Caucasian women, usually of European descent. The farther north you live from the equator, the more common MS is. And then closer to the equator, we actually see a drop-off. And that gradient, that north-south gradient, we really don't understand, but vitamin D and sunlight exposure has been kind of talked about, but there's no firm evidence that vitamin D is a cause of MS, but certainly it's a risk factor, it seems like. And so relapsing remitting MS is the most common. About 85% of MS patients will present with relapsing remitting MS. And what that means is that you have these periods of attacks, and a typical attack lasts maybe 3 weeks or so, and it's followed by recovery. And the recovery is either 100%, symptoms completely resolve, or it's only a partial recovery and you're left with some disability. But then once the attack is gone, people are stable for another period of time and they're so-called in remission. And then until the next attack. And it's very unpredictable, which is what makes, I think, MS very difficult, because you never know when that next attack may come. And it could be anywhere, depending on where your immune system decides to attack your brain. And the symptoms are very varied, because it depends on where the damage occurs. Your eyes could be damaged, your thinking, bladder, energy levels, strength, numbness, sexual dysfunction, all of that is all part of MS. And the other type of MS is actually secondary progressive MS. And secondary progressive MS is actually just simply late stage relapsing remitting. So relapsing remitting MS is typically what most people get, 85% of people get at the time of diagnosis when they're young. After about 10 to 20 years, relapsing remitting MS actually shifts gears, regardless of whether you've been treated or whether you're on treatment. And it becomes more of a progressive type course, meaning that you don't have a clear onset of any symptoms. It's not a clear, you know, I got a relapse or an attack in March 2011, and then it lasted a few days and went away. When people are in a progressive phase of MS, it's really vague. It started sometime in the year 2011. And it's just a slow and steady worsening day by day of some symptom, whether it be thinking, it may be energy, it may be heat sensitivity, it may be just generalized weakness or one leg going weak or incoordinated. And secondary progressive MS usually takes over in almost every MS patient who starts off with relapsing remitting MS. And that transition typically occurs in about, you know, anywhere from the 15 to 20-year mark, sometimes 25-year mark. And when that happens, the relapses actually slow down. They become fewer and farther apart. And then what takes its place is this slow and steady progression that actually doesn't really have an end to it, and it doesn't actually ever recover. So you have a slow and steady progression with no actual recovery in between. And that marks the beginning of what we call secondary progressive, which is the second type of MS. And most everyone will go through this transition. And those are the two most common types of MS. And it's really important to understand what type of MS you have, because it's going to determine your response to treatment, and it affects when you use these treatments, and then you have to consider side effects. So, for example, in relapsing remitting MS, you really have an excellent response to most all of the therapies that the FDA has approved. That means the injectables, the oral drugs, even Tysabri. But once you shift into the secondary progressive phase, almost everyone will start having a decrease in response, meaning that the medicines work less and less, and the relapses become fewer, not because the medicines are still working, but because actually you're starting to shift into a secondary progressive phase. When that happens, kind of the window of opportunity to treat actually comes to a close. But there's a huge, I mean, it could span 10 years for this transition, and it overlaps. So the transition from relapsing remitting to secondary progressive has a huge overlap, and we still keep treating as long as you still have evidence of attacks and inflammatory activity, and there's signs that there's still going to be good treatment response. And even when someone is purely secondary progressive, the medicines still help, but just not as much as we know they do in relapsing remitting. And then, so when you're in that secondary progressive phase, we know that you're not going to respond to treatment as well. That means that we have to shift gears and not expose you to a medicine that has a lot of high risks for fatal brain infections or fatal, you know, serious complications. Because when you're late stage, you're not going to respond as well as you would have in the early stage, and yet you will get 100% of the side effects, the same as early stage. So that means that that ratio between risk and benefit shifts. And you have to be mindful of that, because if you keep someone on aggressive therapy for their whole duration of their MS, their response decreases, and yet their risks to the side effects stay the same. And then you may put someone inadvertently at risk, at more risk than is warranted, because their response is much less. So those are some of the factors that neurologists think about in terms of choosing a medicine and actually discussing with you why you might want to choose one medicine over another. And I think that the type of MS that you have and the phase of MS makes a big difference. Now, in terms of the other types of MS, there's two other types. There's primary progressive and progressive relapsing. Those are primary progressive, there is no treatment for, unfortunately. And that type of MS is fortunately less common, probably about 10% of MS patients. It typically affects men and women equally, and people are older at the time of diagnosis, typically in their 50s. And so that's kind of the one positive thing about primary progressive MS. Even though there's no treatment, people usually have escaped the relapsing phase, and they didn't have any signs of disease in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and really it comes on in later life, and they don't have any attacks. It's just a slow and steady progression without a clear start date, no clear end date, and it's just a slow and steady progression, usually without any recovery. So that type, unfortunately, has no FDA-approved drug for. It's a huge area of research. There's actually a clinical trial on Gilenya, the oral pill, on primary progressive MS, and that study should close in a few years, and we should have results as to whether Gilenya is going to be beneficial in primary progressive MS. But so far, we don't have any treatments that we know about. And we can talk about the pathophysiology of that later, but basically, it's a different type of disease that's characterized more by loss of fiber rather than actual attacks on the myelin. But you do get both in primary progressive MS. And then relapsing progressive MS is actually very uncommon, probably less than 5% of MS. And that's characterized by a slow and steady progression from the beginning, but intermittent attacks as well. So they kind of get both. And that is actually considered a relapsing form of MS because you still have relapses. So those types of MS we still treat also with the standard therapies. But for the most part, most people start out with relapsing remitting. Then after about 15, 20, maybe 25 years, do a switch to secondary progressive. And so that's kind of the background in which to talk about the treatments. I'm going to actually stop right there and see it, and open it up to questions and answers. If anyone has any questions about the things that I've said, the epidemiology, the types of MS, and any questions so far before I go further.
In order to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your touch-tone keypad. There are 4 questions in the queue, and the first question is from Lynn. Lynn, please go ahead.
Yeah, I've been diagnosed since 1989, so that's 23 years.
Yeah.
Wondering if it's worthwhile to continue with my disease-modifying medicine. I'm taking Copaxone currently.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a really good question, and that's actually something that I think every patient needs to ask that question. Generally, yes, we still do, because your response to treatment isn't going to be as good as when you were relapsing, clearly having attacks in the first 20 years, but you still have response to treatment, and it's just waning and fading as time goes by. Now, the good news is that most MS patients, when you hit your 70s, and it really kind of is not so much how long you've had MS, so much as actually how old you are. When people hit their 70s, what I find is that the immune system has aged. And when the immune system has aged, it's really not good at attacking viruses and bacteria, which is why elderly people actually start getting sick and have to get more vaccinations. They're more susceptible to infections. But remember, that same immune system that attacks viruses and bacteria is also the same system that's attacking your own myelin. So a lot of autoimmune diseases, and MS is immune-mediated, and it's arguable whether it's autoimmune, but for the most part, we consider MS an autoimmune disease. When you get your 70s and get older, the immune system actually is aging as well, and it's actually much less likely to attack your immune system. So a lot of people with MS in their 70s, that's when you start pulling people off of therapies, because the MS is just unlikely to have, you're not likely to have an attack when you're in your 70s. The immune system isn't going to attack your myelin. It's also not going to attack viruses and bacteria, which is why elderly people get sick. So the treatment then focuses really to just supportive, meaning managing the symptoms the disability that you already have, and just supportive. And then other medical problems like hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, strokes, heart attacks, those things become more in the forefront for the elderly patient. So in terms of whether or not you should be treated, the first thing is you got to talk to your neurologist to ask that question. And there's a lot of factors that we look at, but we do look at whether there is any evidence of inflammatory activity. And if you continue to have enhancement on your MRI brain scan, meaning that your lesions are still active, sucking up contrast when they give you gadolinium, that means there's inflammation. That means that blood-brain barrier is broken down. The vessels are leaky, allowing immune cells into your brain to attack it. And also that's why contrast seeps in and highlights these spots and they light up. And we call that enhancement. That's good evidence that you are still responsive to therapies, because the medicines are very good about shutting down that blood-brain barrier and stopping immune inflammatory activity. But the other thing is looking at whether or not you've had any relapses. And then the other thing is looking at how stable have you been in the last 5 years. And if you're truly stable, you could consider, and your MRI is stable, you could talk to your neurologist about the potential of taking a break to see if you have any decline. And when I say take a break, you're talking about a one-year interval, because you have to give it a lot of time. You're not going to see much change in anyone's MS, whether they're on treatment or not, in just a short few months. So you have to, whenever you're evaluating whether medicine is working, you got to be on it long enough, because MS attacks are actually not that frequent. The average MS person has only about one attack every 3 years. That means you can go off therapy for 2-3 years, and you'll think that you're stable, but then an attack will come. And that may, if you're on therapy, you might think that your therapy is working. So you have to actually give it enough time. And usually we do a one-year trial off therapy in the older patient who we think is secondary progressive and has been stable for a long time, no evidence of MRI brain lesions that are active, no change on the MRI except for maybe shrinkage, and then no attack. And then if you are stable off of therapy for a year, meaning your exam is stable, your MRI doesn't pick up new spots after you stop therapy, you've not had any relapses after stopping therapy, you really could probably consider stopping therapy. And then, but you have to keep monitoring. The key is you don't just say bye to your neurologist. You have to keep going back for those, periodic brain scans, because remember that brain lesions are silent. That's why we monitor it, is that most spots aren't associated with the symptom. But over time, you get enough of them, the brain can't compensate, and you will start getting symptoms, usually in the form of trouble thinking or fatigue or heat sensitivity. So that's a really tough question, and I think that deserves to be, a discussion that you have with your neurologist. And then if you stop therapy for a year and you do have a relapse or you do have some decline, then you get back on therapy. And what you've risked there is one new spot or one attack, which most attacks will recover with remyelination. And so you've not risked much, but you've answered the question as to whether you need to be on therapy. So that's my personal style of management, but every neurologist is different. And you're gonna meet different theories and philosophies, but basically this is pretty standard in terms of if you go to an MS specialist, as to it's always hard to pull people off therapies. When do you do that? That's always a subject of debate. And some people just say continue as long as you can until you're very old, and then pull people off of therapies then. But I think that there are side effects of these medications, and it's worth discussing this if you're clearly in the secondary progressive. In general, I keep treating people you know, as long as there's evidence of decline, even like secondary progressive, if you're still declining, I think the medicines still have benefit, much less so. And I still think some treatment is better than nothing. But you have to shift gears, and you might go back to, say, the safer drugs, the injectables in the late stages, not maybe something that has a risk of some serious infection. Knowing that you're not going to respond as well, you probably want to downgrade it so that you don't have the risks of, you know, serious side effects like death or infection or cancer or something, you know, in order to balance that knowing that your efficacy is waning. Okay, does that answer your question?
Much younger than 70 right now. I'm 63.
Yeah.
And I go to Coeur d'Alene occasionally. I have a daughter that lives there. Mm-hmm. I didn't get your name. I would like to meet you face-to-face sometime.
Louisa Levy. I'm at Kootenai Neurology Clinic. I'd be happy to see you and give you some information. And again, this is something that I think that your neurologist is capable also of discussing, but I'd be happy to see you. So.
Okay, and the next question is from Lee. Lee, please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Lee.
Hi, thank you. I'm in my late 40s, and I was only just diagnosed in March.
Yeah.
And my neurologist, I've asked several times, what type of MS do I have? And my neurologist has not answered me.
it may not be clear. At the time of diagnosis, if you've only had one episode and you don't, like, especially if it's optic neuritis, because optic neuritis can be part of primary progressive as well as relapsing remitting. And, you know, you have to give it time. The diagnosis of MS is a diagnosis of exclusion, first off. You have to make sure you don't have a mimicker of MS. Then you have to, so there's a lot of, that's why there's the diagnosis itself takes so much time and testing. Once you've excluded other things and you're confident that it's demyelinating, then you're pretty sure it's some type of MS, but it could also be other demyelinating diseases like neuromyelitis optica or, you know, spinal optic MS, which is more common in the Asian countries. There's still a lot of other potential demyelinating diseases. So with a single episode, it's sometimes hard to say exactly what type you will convert into. If you look at the brain scan, it's not going to help you. The brain scan can look very much the same in the beginning stages. Over time, we do have differences. So, for example, primary progressive MS is much more likely to hit the spinal cord and cause atrophy of the eyes than it is to attack the brain, but it still attacks the brain. Relapsing remitting MS is classically about 80% of activities all in the brain, and then maybe 20% in the cervical cord. So those little differences can help a neurologist figure out what type you have, but it's really, you got to watch over time. And to diagnose, say, primary progressive, in the criteria, you have to have a year-long progression of symptoms continuously without any other cause, and it has to come without healing and without kind of a relapse with recovery. And it's only after a year of that, of watching decline, that you can say, gosh, I think you have primary progressive MS. So, and that's really common. And if you were diagnosed really early, you might not even qualify for MS yet. You might be in the pre-MS stage that we call clinically isolated syndrome. And the treatment then is still worthwhile. Even primary progressive MS patients, even though there's no proven therapy, I still treat because I try to gear it towards maybe neuroprotective agents that preserve brain volume or spinal cord volume. Because it's still worthwhile because it's always a spectrum. It's not a clear-cut type. So the difference between relapsing, remitting, and primary progressive, you might be on a spectrum where you have some progressive symptoms and relapsing. And your response to treatment is best determined by a trial. And if you start a treatment, you watch over a year or 2 years. If you respond, great, you stay on it. If you continue to decline, you can stop it, see if you decline further. So I think your neurologist probably just needs more time to figure it out. And if not, after a year or so, you should have a good idea what type of MS you have. But it's still, if you've already started therapy, it's okay. Even virtually all types of MS, we still try. And we still have just those FDA, you know, 7 FDA-approved drugs, 8 if you count Xdavia, which is kind of the same as Betaseron. But, you know, it's still worth a trial of therapy. And so if you've started on therapy, probably the subtype is not so important as the fact that you've started therapy or at least trying, and time will tell what type of MS you have, and time will tell your response to treatment.
Okay, and the next question is from Josephine. Josephine, please go ahead.
Hi, Josephine.
Hi, doctor. How are you?
Good. Thanks for asking.
I was diagnosed in 1992. I'm 67 now, and I was diagnosed in 1992. So that's 20 years ago. I guess my main question, because I live out here on the island of Kauai in the Hawaiian archipelago, which is very nice, but I don't ever feel well anymore. And there's no doctor here. There's one neurologist on our island who doesn't treat MS patients. So
he does not.
During an attack, too, my husband took me to Honolulu, and we saw a neurologist there. And his opinion was that I should immediately go on betasterone. He had a new scan done, and the scan showed, he said, one time he told me it was the same as before, and the next time he told me it was very different. And there were, quote, black holes. I read the report, black holes in the brain, indicating a worsening of the disease. Saw another doctor there who said he didn't think I should have treatment because of my age. So, and nobody has ever said, like the previous caller, what type I have. I believe at this point that I'm primary progressive. I had an attack in my 20s, one in my 30s, which were misdiagnosed, and then finally a diagnosis in 92. I never feel good anymore, and I'm just, it's fatigue, not even fatigue, it's weakness and pain all the time. And so I don't even know at this point whether... like I said, the first doctor said betasterone immediately. Yeah. The other doctor said
And you're going to, you know, this is a problem with any specialty. You're going to get different opinions no matter where you go. Different doctors just think differently. They're trained differently. But in general, if you've had different answers from different people, I think it's worth a trip if you ever come to the mainland to one of these major academic centers and actually seeing an MS specialist at an MS center and actually just clarifying just that very question. What type of MS do I have now, and what type of did I start with? And if you, you know, in general, if you've had an attack, that puts you in the relapsing category. But you have to make sure it was truly an attack and not, you know. So I think it's all going to be clarified with a very careful history, probably getting records if it's available. And you could really tease that apart as to what type of MS you have. And then some people just progress very rapidly within the first year of diagnosis. That's uncommon, but it's possible. And even though you go rapidly into a progressive course, you still may have been at least relapsing at some point. And once, if you're relapsing, then it opens up the potential for response to therapies. And that's something that I just because you've seen two neurologists with two vastly different opinions, you probably should go to an MS center. And it doesn't have to be now. It could be when it's convenient, when the weather is nice and you can afford to fly, whatever it might be, just make an appointment with an MS center and an MS-trained neurologist. And I think you're going to get a much clearer answer than someone, because it's probably uncommon to have a lot of MS in Hawaii, but it's still possible. And the subtypes might be different. It's a predominantly Asian population, so you're going to see a different subtype. If you're European Caucasian ancestry, you're going to have a different subtype potentially. So, but those things are actually best teased apart by a careful history by a neurologist. But you did mention one thing I wanted to address: T1 black holes. T1 black holes are when we do a brain scan, we actually do many sequences, and it's protocoled, and we look at different things over many sequences. It's not just one scan. And a T1 black hole is actually indicative of not just demyelination, which is ripping off the myelin that's covering the nerve fiber, but actually damage to the nerve fiber itself. And so when the nerve fiber is damaged and severed by a very severe immune attack, you've got damage to the myelin as well as the nerve fiber. That's called axonal loss, and that means that nerve fiber is severed and it's irreversible. It does not heal. But demyelination is damage just to the myelin sheath, but the nerve fiber is still intact. And that's, for the most part, the classic MS patient. And when you have just demyelination, there's a potential for recovery. But the myelin that regrows is thinner, it's more disorganized. Myelin kind of grows like a carpet layer wrapped around a nerve fiber, and you kind of punch a hole through it. And those nerve fibers is then exposed, signal coming down that nerve fiber short circuits when it hits that exposed area. It's just like heating up an electrical cord or short circuiting an electrical cord. So the signal never makes it down to say your leg, and your leg is weak then. But if you have axonal loss, it's severed actually the fiber, and that shows up as literally a hole in the brain scan versus a white dot, which is an area of scarring, sclerosis. And I think that neurologist you saw is right. When we see T1 black holes, it is associated with more disability in a more aggressive course. Some people's attacks on their brain is all axonal and myelin. Some people's it's purely myelin. So, and I think those little nuances are taken into consideration as to whether or not you should be treated. And your age also, and your response to therapy, you know, all of, and side effects and what medical problems you might have. So that's not something that I should answer because I know nothing about you, I haven't examined you, but definitely I think that you can get an answer to that question if you sought out an MS specialist. Okay, I think we should get on with our talk. I'm going to switch gears now and talk about the treatments of MS. And one thing, I did mention I was going to talk about disability, and I kind of just covered that. Disability in MS is actually associated with demyelination. So the more spots in your brain, that indicates more areas of damage, and that's associated with the more spots you have, the more disability you have. And the disability may be in the form of walking problems, thinking problems, lots and lots of different measures. Now, if you have evidence of those T1 black holes that I was just talking about, that's actually associated with a higher degree of irreversible damage. And it's not to say that your symptoms won't get better, because even with axonal loss, your symptoms may get better because your brain will simply use another pathway around that hole. It will find another way to get the signal through by going around it. But those pathways are developed later in life as an adult, not as a child, and they're not as robust, so they tend to break down. They tend to break down if you're stressed, if you haven't slept enough, or if you've got a fever or an infection. And that's kind of the origin of MS symptoms fluctuating widely in an MS patient, good days and bad days. And so demyelination is actually the marker of an early stage MS, and then as it transitions, you still get demyelination, but you also get shrinkage of the brain, and you can see this on a brain scan, and as well as more kind of damage to the fibers. And that's more of the late stage progressive types of MS. And it's again, I can't stress that enough, that it's a gradient. It's not a clear, you know, switch that one day you just suddenly become secondary progressive. There's a big overlap that occurs over years, and it's just a transition. And when you start or when you stop treatment is really individualized. That is clearly individualized based on your preferences, your risk tolerance, your need or desire to be aggressive with treatment, and it's really a discussion that's open-ended between you and your neurologist. Now, the treatment of MS, why do we treat? Well, clearly the MS treatments have come a long ways. We know that the MS therapies reduce relapses. They decrease the severity of the relapses if you're going to have one. They actually push them farther apart so that they're less frequent. And then we also see that disability is lessened and that it takes longer for people to, say, need a cane or assistance with walking when they start treatment early and when they're young, when the disease is early. And so those are all the reasons we treat. And if you understand where your neurologist is coming from, the philosophy behind the therapies, then you're going to be able to take part in the conversation, you're going to be able to ask questions, and you're going to be able to make an informed decision versus a neurologist just telling you that you need to start a drug or just telling you. And I think if you understand that, you're going to have a better idea of what questions to ask just to get this discussion started. And so let's start with a review of the existing therapies. So in 1993, the first drug, betaseron, came out. It's an injection drug. It's an interferon. Then in 1996, Avonex came out, another interferon that's injected in the muscle once a week. Then in the same year, Copaxone came out, and that's an injection that's not an interferon. It's in its own class. It's basically a medicine that was made to mimic myelin to use to study MS, and in the end it was discovered to actually be a treatment. Copaxone is actually injected in the fat, in the subcutaneous layer, and in it's daily. Then in 2002, Rebif came out, another interferon that's three times a week. That's considered high dose, high frequency. And then in 2009, Xdivane came out, which is really identical to betaseron. Literally, I think a company bought the manufacturing plant and had equal rights. And so it's the same medicine. Betaseron and Xdivane come out of the same plant. It's made the same way. They just slap two different labels on it. And so betaseron and Xdivane are just two different companies running the same drug. It's not considered a generic. So basically the injectables Betaseron, Avonex, Copaxone, Rebif, and Xdivane, kind of in the order that they came out, are still our first-line treatments. Now, this is where I think I'm kind of going not off-label, but basically this is the way I manage MS. I have a philosophy of something called escalation therapy, meaning I start with the safest drugs, even though their efficacy may be less in the clinical trials, and I find the drug that works for the patient, and if it fails, then I push them up to a more potentially beneficial drug that has more side effects, and so on. And so that as patients progress, and if they are failing their drugs, their therapies, by having breakthrough relapses or new spots on their MRI brain scan, active spots on their brain scan, or changes on the neuro exam that I see, then I will escalate their therapies from the injectables, which I consider first line, to Gilenya or Tysabri. And then from there, potentially even chemotherapy agents such as Novantrone. And those are all of our FDA-approved drugs as of now. And we don't have any other ones. There are lots of other drugs that are used, but they're not FDA-approved. So, for example, methotrexate or cyclophosphamide. And those are mostly chemotherapy agents. And then, and that's called escalation therapy. Most MS neurologists in MS centers kind of follow this kind of pattern versus, say, someone who is going to hit you hard with a chemotherapy as the first treatment ever, kind of like we treat how we treat cancer, and they do an induction, meaning induction, they try to squelch the disease from the onset with a very powerful toxic medication. And then they back off from that medicine, and then they downgrade the medicine to something safer for maintenance. And that's called induction therapy. And so two very different models of how we manage MS. I would say in Europe, it's more common to do induction therapy, say, which is why Europe has a much higher rate of usage of chemotherapy agents. And they, if someone has a very aggressive disease course from the beginning at the early stage, they're more likely to use chemotherapy for a short period of time to squelch the disease. This is exactly what cancer docs do for tumors. You hit them hard with radiation and chemo from the beginning, squelch the tumor, and then move on to some sort of maintenance therapy. And that's one model of how we treat, is that we do a very powerful induction therapy for a limited period of time, and it's limited because the drugs are toxic. You're talking about chemotherapy agents potentially that have risks of leukemia, risks of cancers, risks of heart toxicity, and so on. And then once the disease has stabilized, then you switch them to, say, one of the injectables and continue them. And you hope that the chemo has acted like a reset switch on their immune system to squelch it. That's induction followed by maintenance. Most docs, though, especially general neurologists, are going to follow an escalation pattern. You start with the safer drugs and move up to more toxic drugs only as the disease progresses and if the MS isn't well controlled. And so that's the model that I will use. But if I see a patient who's highly active and not doing well on the first line therapies in the first year, and I give each therapy about a year long trial, I'll monitor parameters such as MRI brain for stability. So that means whether or not in a year's time there's been any new spots. I'll monitor their exam to see if in a year's time there's been any change in their neuro exam, any decline in strength, vision, reflexes, that sort of thing, gait, balance. And then I'll also monitor the number of attacks they've had. And that just relies on the patient telling me and reporting to me that they've had an attack. I'll note that, and then over a year's time, I'll decide whether or not the therapy has worked. If it's worked, great, they stay on it. If their MRI is stable, no change on exam, and no relapses, that means their therapy is working as far as we can tell. And you kind of take it year by year as to whether you stay on that injectable therapy. And then after some period of time, some people just for whatever reason have breakthrough activity. They start getting spots of their brain scan. If that happens, then you escalate beyond. You can switch classes within the injectables, say go from an interferon to Copaxone or from Copaxone to one of the interferons, and then give it another year-long trial. And then if they fail two classes, meaning an interferon or Copaxone, then I will open it up to potentially Tysabri. And Gilenya has not yet found a clear place, I think, in a lot of neurologists' offices yet, because it's FDA approved for first line, and definitely we use it first line. It's a huge, huge boon to have oral therapy, which is an option for people who are scared of needles, who just didn't tolerate it. But in terms of the toxicity, it still has more toxicities, I think, than the injectables. So we do use Gilenya first line. And don't get me wrong, I also use Gilenya first line. But I think it depends on the patient's medical list. So whether they have diabetes, whether they're older, whether they have heart problems. And we look at actually the oral drug Gilenya very carefully in people who've had heart problems because it can cause a decrease in your heart rate. But I would put Gilenya in a gray box between first line and potentially second line. And I use Gilenya when clearly it's safe. People without any heart history, people who are not on any blood pressure medication that slows down their heart rate, people without any concern for side effects due to Gilenya. And then if they fail that, then I go on to, say, Tysabri. And I do use Tysabri second line. It's actually FDA approved for second line, meaning you have to fail something anyway to get Tysabri. But some docs do use Tysabri first line, as first off the bat, and I've done that too in very severe patients. Again, it's all tailored into individual patients and how aggressive your disease is. But for the most part, we start with the injectables, plus or minus Gilenya. I think it depends on your neurologist. Gilenya is, from talking to other general neurologists and MS docs, it's really a lot of general neurologists use it first line, a lot of general neurologists use it second line, somewhere in between. And then second line would be Tysabri, which is an infusion drug for MS that's given once a month, very powerful. So I'm actually going to back up and give more specifics on each drug. That's kind of basically a big overview as to how we choose the drug, why, and then also how we escalate as your disease progresses. And then let me just back up to I'll just break it down to the injectables. So the interferons. All around, the interferons are roughly equal in efficacy. So in several major clinical trials that are all very well-designed, large number, placebo-controlled, very well-designed studies, we've been able to show that the interferons reduce relapses over an inert substance called the placebo. So when we say placebo-controlled trials, it means that the medicine in question has been compared against an inert substance that the person taking it has no idea if they're taking a sugar pill or the actual drug. And we've shown that the interferons roughly drop relapses by about 33%. 27 to 33% is kind of the range for the interferons, but they're all really roughly equal in efficacy. The main side effects of the interferons, that would be Betaseron, Avonex, and Rebif, as well as Xdivane, flu-like side effects. So I think that's the major downside besides the fact that they're injections. Flu-like side effects actually last anywhere from 1 to 3 days for Avonex, which is actually longer because it's only once a week. Your body doesn't get used to it as much, so the flu-like side effects tend to last a little bit longer. But the good news is after 6 months of treatment, usually flu-like side effects markedly decrease, and it's manageable with Tylenol and ibuprofen. When I say flu-like side effects, I usually mean, you know, maybe a mild increase in temperature, but it could be a fever. It's usually muscle aching and soreness and feeling tired, kind of like you have the flu. But it's not usually diarrhea. There's usually very little GI upset. And then the other interferons, Betaseron, Rebif, and Xdivane, are actually interferons that are injected in the fat. Avonex is once a week in the muscle. Betaseron is every other day in the fat. Rebif is 3 times a week in the fat. And Xdivane is also every other day in the fat. And because you're injecting every other day or, you know, 3 times a week, it's very frequent. So your body actually gets used to it much quicker. So flu-like side effects for the subcutaneous fat injections of the interferons is actually about 8 hours. So people typically take it at bedtime with the Tylenol or ibuprofen or both and sleep through the majority of the flu-like side effects, and they wake up a little bit sore and hungover, but usually by mid-morning it's gone. And again, all of the interferons flu-like side effects burn off usually about 6 months or later, and or at least markedly get better. And if they don't, that's potentially a reason to stop. If your flu-like side effects increase or don't go away, and you're losing quality weekend time as a result, or you know, your quality of life is suffering, that's a reason to stop, even if it is working, because I think you need to find a medicine that works with your lifestyle that you can take. And if I find that someone is skipping injections because they can't tolerate the flu-like side effects, well, it's not going to help them if they're skipping. So I just simply switch them to something and find something that they can tolerate. And so the other injectable is Copaxone, and it's not an interferon. It's in its own class. It's a polymer that looks, that's made to look like myelin. It was designed in Israel for research purposes, and it was found to actually seem to be protective in mouse models of MS, and then they did a clinical trial and showed that it was actually effective in MS patients, again, with about roughly a third decrease in relapses. So that means that if you were to have three relapses in a year, the injectables will cut down one of them. You would only have two. Now, contrast that, but again, keep in mind, very, very safe. The interferons, you have to do some liver monitoring, white blood count monitoring, because it can drop your white count sometimes, but with adjustment, you can squeak by, and that can normalize. Same thing with your liver. And the interferons can increase depression, so you have to watch for that. It's potentially treatable, though. You could treat through it, but if you can't and become suicidal, then that's a reason to stop. Copaxone has no monitoring, but the downside of Copaxone is that it's every day. And the other major side effect I didn't mention is injections. All of these are injections, and the ones in the fat are irritating and can cause injection site reactions that cause swelling, including Copaxone. Avonex is actually the only one in the muscle because it doesn't go in the fat. It's less irritating, and it doesn't actually cause significant injection site reactions. So those are the injectables, all around about a third reduction. So then the next drug that came out on the market was actually Tysabri. And Tysabri is FDA approved for relapsing forms of MS. It's a monthly infusion. It's known as a monoclonal antibody, which is it basically works on your T cells. And it prevents your T cells, which are responsible for most people's MS attacks, from entering into the brain space. And as a result, it basically stops entry of the cells that attack your brain. And so people tend to have a very good response rate, and it actually drops relapses by 67%. So if you were to have three relapses in a year, the injectables will cut back one of them. Tysabri would cut back two of them. You would only have one. And Tysabri then has a major side effect, which is why we don't use it first line unless it's really warranted, because of the risk of a brain infection caused by a virus called the JC virus. And the risk of that, we're starting to get a better understanding. If you carry this virus in your body, and about half of us are exposed, like 56% of us are exposed to this virus and carry it, it's benign if you're a healthy, normal, you know, person without AIDS or without the use of Tysabri or chemo. Most of us who carry it, about half of us do, it doesn't cause any problems. It actually lives in your kidneys. The JC virus lives in your kidneys, may periodically reactivate, but your immune system kind of cuts it down. If you are on Tysabri, however, if the JC virus and you happen to have it, it can reactivate and then mutate into a form that can cause a brain infection. And if that JC virus happens to travel into your brain and actually grow there, then Tysabri prevents your immune system from going in to actually fight that infection. And this very, very weak virus that typically causes no problems in the healthy person, when you throw Tysabri on board, if it happens to reactivate, happens to pick up this mutation, then travel into the brain space and grow, then it can cause this brain infection called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or PML. And that is a serious infection because we have no cure for it. What we do is we recognize it and immediately stop the Tysabri. We let your immune system kind of reconstitute, let your T cells then enter into your brain space. And it takes some time to do that because of the effects of Tysabri. And once you stop the Tysabri, then over time, over weeks, then your immune system then goes back into the brain and fights the infection. But in the meantime, it's done its damage. And so when we first discovered PML and Tysabri, that was in 2006, it led to Tysabri being pulled off the market, but then it was reintroduced under the TOUCH program. We now have a new test called the JC virus antibody test that you can actually get for free. It's done through Quest. Your neurologist can test you for it. You can actually test your status. Are you a carrier of the JC virus or are you not? If you're a carrier and I give you Tysabri, then you might be at risk for PML. If you don't carry it, then your risk is much lower, but it's still not zero because the test is not perfect. There's a 3% chance that you're going to test negative for the JC virus, but you actually have it. That's the false negative rate of the test because no lab test is perfect. And so with the advent of this JC virus antibody test, and it just came out summer of 2011, we now can stratify people into categories of risk for PML. So if you are positive for the JC virus and get Tysabri, you're at risk for this infection. And if you don't carry it, we presume that your risk of getting it is very low, but still not impossible because you can pick up the virus at any time. It's a very common virus, and we would actually test you on an annual basis to make sure that you continue to stay negative as long as you're on Tysabri. Now, if you are a carrier of JC virus, what does that mean? What does it mean if I give you Tysabri? It means that after 2 years of therapy, your risk for getting this brain infection is about 2 in 1,000. That reduces down to about 1 in 500. So, and if you get it, originally about a third of people died who got this brain infection. A third would recover, and then a third would just be devastated cognitively, kind of nursing level care, just losing all independence. But now that we know about PML, we now have this virus test, antibody test that we can risk stratify patients into and really do counseling and actually tell people how to recognize PML and catch it earlier, the survival rate is actually improved. And it's actually dropped to about 20% death rate with a much better chance of recovery. But still a very serious side effect. But there are ways to actually monitor, ways to make it safe. We go through the TOUCH program. You have to be a provider that's trained to give it. The nurses who give it have to be trained through a program. So I think there's definitely a time and the right place for Tysabri if your disease is severe enough to warrant it and you've tried all of the other safer options, or if your disease is just so severe from the get-go, we don't have time for the injectables to kick in, which sometimes takes 3 to 6 months to ramp in, then we might hit you hard with Tysabri in the beginning, potentially for a limited period of time in an induction model. You know, these are all the details that it's really individualized. There's no right way of choosing these therapies for each and every, that we can make a blanket statement for. It's really individualized. But I think the most important thing is that you understand the options, you understand the side effects, you know the risks and the benefits, and you have a discussion with your neurologist. So those are basically our disease-modifying therapies. I've left out one, and that's actually Novantrone, which is a chemotherapy agent that's really gotten less usage as time has gone by and more therapies have evolved. And Novantrone is mitoxantrone. It's a chemotherapy agent that we've used. It's FDA approved for secondary progressive MS, the only therapy that's been approved for secondary progressive MS. Otherwise, we still use the first line, the other drugs for secondary progressive, but mitoxantrone can still be used for secondary progressive MS. But it is a chemotherapy agent. It's an infusion drug. It basically is given once every 3 months, and you can only get about 2 years' worth before you reach a toxic level. It's associated with heart failure, cardiotoxicity, and that effect can be delayed after 5 years, but it's most common in the first 5 years. That rate, the risk is probably about 2 to 3% of heart failure. And then there's a risk of leukemia, of drug-induced leukemia. Again, anywhere from 1 to 2%. Risk of future leukemia if you've received mitoxantrone. And mitoxantrone is the response is dose-dependent and also the toxicities are dose-dependent. So if you go on to get the full dose, the maximum that's allowed, and for the full 2 years, you're more likely to get the side effects. But if you just take a little, maybe sparingly, then you might be able to get away without side effects. But again, this is something that you have to talk with your neurologist about as an option, and you have to consider your other options that may be safer. But at the same time, you have to look at how aggressive your disease is. If you're using it to potentially, say, keep your independence, when it's you're talking about the ability to walk versus the ability or the need for a wheelchair and assisted living facilities or nursing homes, that's where I think these more toxic drugs have a role, and it's all about individualizing the therapy and understanding risk and making an informed decision as to when we use them. So that's kind of an overview of the therapies. I'm running out of time, and I wanted to actually get on to the newer drugs. I'll just really briefly mention and then open it up for questions again. The really exciting thing is that this is all of our therapies have come out since 1993, and it's such an exciting time because so many drugs are in the pipeline. So next year, the first drug that we expect on the market is actually BG12. And we don't have another name for it, but it's dimethyl fumarate. It's an oral drug. It's twice per day. The main side effects of this drug is actually flushing and diarrhea. And the flushing seems to be treatable with aspirin. Hit or miss, you know, if you get the side effects, diarrhea may be something that causes you to have to stop the medicine, but it may not. But the promising thing about BG12, it has an efficacy rate that's much higher than the injectable, slightly less than Gilenya, and the efficacy rate is about 47%. And I forgot to mention, the injectables have 33% effectiveness at relapse reduction. Gilenya, the oral pill, is about 54% effective at reducing relapses, so it cuts them in half. Tysabri is about 67% effective at relapse reduction, so it cuts it by two-thirds. And BG12 cuts it about, you know, close to 50%, something in the 40s. But the promising thing about BG12 is that there have been no deaths associated with it. So I tell patients, this drug hasn't killed anyone. So that's important to actually consider, even though it does have side effects. So anyway, that's a very promising drug that the FDA is reviewing now. It should be available, we think, sometime in the spring to early summer. Hopefully it's on the market by then. Yet another oral option. And then after that, we have teriflunomide, which is a twice-per-day oral drug that cuts relapses roughly in the 30s, is the relapse reduction rate, has some side effects as well. And then we have liquidamide, yet another oral drug coming out. And then so we have three more oral drugs coming out down the pipeline that are yet to be approved. And we have three more infusion therapies, basically monoclonal antibodies, newer versions of a medication that's called rituximab, for example. So those are all the things coming down the pipeline. They're all at various stages of research and are probably within several years of FDA review and therefore submission or approval. And we're expecting lots of new drugs within the next several years. So that's what's exciting. Okay. And I'll open up to the questions now.
Okay, to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone phone. There are 7 questions in queue. The first question is from Kristen. Kristen, please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kristen. Thank you for taking my question. I was just recently put on Copaxone about 2 months ago, and I would like to know, how do I know that that disease-modifying drug is actually working for me?
Yeah.
Because I don't feel anything different. I don't feel any better.
No, that's an excellent question. That's kind of that I want everyone to kind of understand that. And how do you know your drug is working? And again, it kind of goes back to what I was saying. Well, we monitor. We monitor you for changes in your exam. So if you're getting weaker with every visit that your neurologist notices, or your imbalance, or, you know, some change on your neurologic exam, that would be a sign that you've got more activity. If you have relapses, attacks that you know is happening, so some symptom that you've never had before, weakness of a leg, bladder dysfunction, optic neuritis, something that develops over days, you have an attack that lasts 3 weeks and then it's followed by recovery, that's a relapse. If you start having relapses on Copaxone, if you have changes in your neuro exam, and then the other third thing that we follow is your MRI. If your MRI brain scan is stable, now remember, none of these drugs, the FDA approved drugs, result in recovery. All of these drugs, all they do is prevent progression, hopefully as much as it can, prevent progression of the disease, prevent relapses, slow down the number of spots forming on your MRI brain scan. What they do is prevent you from getting worse. None of these drugs make you feel better. In fact, they all give you side effects, injection site reactions, flu-like side effects. So day to day, when you take these medicines, they do make you feel worse. But you have to think of them as an investment in your future. That by taking these 10 years down the road, you're going to see the benefit because the accumulation of damage will be less. And you have to take into account aging. The aging brain adds on to the effects of your damage from the MS. And a lot of people don't see the effects of damage in their 20s and 30s with those spots because the young, healthy brain compensates. And then as it ages, then you start seeing the effects of those spots. The brain's ability to compensate breaks down as it gets older. It atrophies naturally with age. Everyone's brain at 90 looks like a raisin. Almost everyone. There's some lucky people who don't. And that effect is actually going to cause your symptoms to kind of be amplified with aging effects. So when you are on therapies, all you hope for is that you're the same on your MRI, no relapses, and same on your neuro exam. That's how you know it's working. And if you can go over X number of years without any change and you beat the statistics of the average rate of formation of spots that we know that other patients are experiencing or average rate of relapses that other patients are experiencing, and you beat that mean, then we know that it's working for you. But if you're more active than the average MS patient that should be at your stage of the disease, then we push it further. Then we escalate your therapy to something that's maybe more efficacious or more toxic. Now, not everyone is going to have an equal response. You have to find the people who are going to be responders to Copaxone or the responders to the interferons. And only the people who do not respond do we push on. If you respond to the safer drugs, we leave you on it because that's what you hope for is just stability, not improvement. If you improve, it's because your brain has had a chance to heal. And most every relapse is followed by recovery. It's your own brain healing. It's not the medicines. Even steroids don't result in better recovery. All they do is speed up the recovery. So if you've only been on Copaxone for 2 months, it's not enough time. You have to give it at least a year-long trial. And, in fact, the interferons, the injectables, they take several months to kick in, at least 3 months usually. So if you have a relapse or a new spot in the first 3 months of startup of your injectable, well, you're still on the titration, upward titration. It's not yet kicked in. You got to evaluate it after 3 months of the initiation and give it a year-long trial. And that's why we do brain scans every year. That's why you should see your neurologist on an annual basis, and that's why we ask you to report to us how many relapses you're having. Just a simple phone call so it can be documented in the computer for the next visit to talk about. So it's those three markers, relapses, your neuro exam, and your MRI brain changes. Those three markers are what we follow to determine if your medicine's working. Does that make sense?
Okay, and the next question is from Stacy.
Okay.
Stacy, please go ahead.
Hi, Stacy.
Thank you. Hi. I was wondering, I've noticed this last week in the on articles and stuff like that over the internet and everything. I know it's the internet. There's been a study, I guess, reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Mm-hmm.
That the interferon beta drugs have little or no effect on a person's progression in the disability.
Disability progression.
Yeah. Is that true, or should a person change drugs?
It's very controversial. And actually, some of the problem is a lot of the studies that we've been looking at aren't long enough to truly determine disability progression. But yes, that JAMA study was written by Dr. Tremlett. She was the principal investigator. She's a doctor up in Canada at the University of British Columbia. And Dr. Tremlett and her group and colleagues basically have looked at long-term data from various cohorts of people and actually looked at whether or not treatment with interferons in particular results in decrease in disability. And what they found is that they don't think it does. So what she's implying is that all of what we've been studying, which is basically relapse reduction, does relapse reduction result in actually better function down the line? And I think she's raising that question as maybe not. What we may need to be looking at is actually not the number of relapses that a medicine cuts down, but progression. But the problem is we have no marker of progression other than looking at brain size and shrinkage, and it's much harder to study. And I think some of the findings is potentially due to the fact that we don't have a clear measure of progression other than measuring perhaps how long it takes for someone to need a cane, how long does it take for someone to need a wheelchair. It's really hard to quantify progression when it's slow and steady and it's unending versus an attack. It's really easy to count attacks. You have a symptom that starts and it goes away. It recovers, and it's really easy to study relapses. So this study, it's generated a lot of interest and a lot of discussion, and I think that there's some truth to it for sure, that our focus is so much on relapses that it's not definitive that relapse reduction definitely results in this reduction in disability down the line. But the problem is we have not studied it, I think, patients long enough. And there have definitely been studies that show that controlling relapses through these therapies does, in fact, result in reduction in disability, clearly. So there's something that we're missing, because there's definitely very well-designed studies that show that relapse reduction is correlated with reduction in disability, and usually our marker is probably how long does it take for someone to need a cane or a walker or some other marker of disability. But her study, her findings in particular, those populations she looked at, it wasn't as clear. And I think that right now it doesn't change what we do. We still have to just go by the clinical studies that have already been done, and that's mostly looking at MRI spots and relapses. But I think that what she found is very valid in the sense that we need to reshift our focus not on relapse reduction only, but we need to look at relapse reduction and how do we prevent progression? How do we prevent the shrinkage in the brain, the loss of axon fibers, not just the spots of demyelination? And that's where when I went, I don't know if you remember, when I went through early stage MS is demyelination, late stage MS is usually more axonal loss and shrinkage and actually loss of fibers. Those are the two phases of MS that everyone transitions from. Relapsing remitting demyelination in the beginning attacks, and then everyone progresses at some point into a progressive phase characterized by loss of fibers and less attacks. And we don't have any treatment for that later stage. We know that our current treatments, which are geared towards relapses, don't work for the progressive phase. So I think her findings are in keeping with that, that we need to shift and find medicines that not only reduce attacks, but also reduce shrinkage in the brain, reduce progression, and we need other markers than relapses. We need to look at strength and quantifying strength. We need to look at ways to quantify heat sensitivity, fatigue, all of the really hard measures that are hard to actually gauge in a clinical trial because we have no tools to measure those things. You know, we could do neuropsych testing, but it's so time intensive and there's so many confounding variables. I think she's uncovered basically an area of research that's needed. Areas that we are focusing on, clearly, we are really focusing on neuroprotective drugs that are potentially working more in the progressive phases of disease. I think it's not so clear-cut, though. I don't think it's a cut and dry that none of the therapies don't, you know, that the therapies don't help disability. I think it's an element, and I think when you look at particular populations, you're going to have variable results. So I read that paper, and I actually think that it just means that we need to design clinical trials that looks at a different endpoint, not just relapse reduction, but actually progression. And we don't have that right now, and I think that's a point of future research. So, but having said that, it doesn't mean you should give up on your medicines. There's plenty of data that shows that the medicines actually do help, and most all, and if the FDA would not have approved these drugs if it didn't show that. But I think that it just uncovers an area of needed research and that the cause of MS is much more complicated than we think, and even treatment response is much more complicated than we think. And we need to expand our thinking from not just relapses to actually more looking at progression and shrinkage, other things. So the message is they still stay on your medicines. They still work. Any next question?
Okay. The next question is from Michael. Michael, please go ahead.
Yeah.
Hi, can you hear me? I don't know if I have my little phone muted off.
Nope, I can hear you just fine, Michael.
Okay, thank you. My actual questions are about medications that are being looked at for assistance in recovery, such as anti-lingo and what might be going on with stem cell research.
Okay, so I'll speak about stem cell research. Stem cell research is actually really a big area of research. And my background is at University of Washington, so I'll speak about the HALT MS study. So when I was there as a fellow, we transplanted about 28 patients through the HALT MS study with MS. And what we found is that stem cell transplants, what that means is that a patient with MS is given a medicine that causes their T cells and B cells, the kind of the young cells, to mobilize. And then it's harvested and collected and stored. And then the patient is given some high dose of chemotherapy or sometimes just radiation, some means of actually killing their immune system. And it brings them to the verge of just great toxicity, and their immune system is then killed off by chemotherapy agents. And then they're without an immune system, so they're highly vulnerable to infections. They're like a newborn baby with just a burgeoning kind of growing immune system. You rescue that patient with their own immune system. Cells that you had harvested and set aside. And then that's called an autologous stem cell transplant. Those cells will then take place and take hold and regrow. And somehow that process is like a reset switch. And we know what we found is that method of treating MS is effective if you do the transplant in the early relapsing stages of MS. If you were to transplant a primary progressive patient or a late-stage secondary progressive patient, it doesn't seem to have any difference. They continue to progress because they're not having relapses. The stem cell transplant seems to work best for the early stage, just like our therapies do, and they seem to stop relapses. And we have data at least 5 years out, and we think it's effective at least for 5 years at being able to stop new spots and actually cut down attacks so that people are able to get off therapies. And so stem cell transplants we're looking at how to make it safer. So mortality in the first stem cell transplants that were ever done were actually upwards of 10% risk of death. And the death complications were usually due to the chemo agent that was used, from the side effects of those, or from infections. So once you kill someone's immune system before you've had a chance for their immune system to take hold again, they can get just common viruses, common flus, common infections, bacterial infections that then just kill them if you can't control it with antibiotics. So it's still considered high risk, and most institutions who do stem cell transplants are still research protocols that are funded by NIH and various grants, and it's definitely an option. But you have to go probably to a very reputable site that has a protocol that has a much lower risk of fatality and complications than, say, somewhere that's not. And if you go online, you're going to see lots of places that offer stem cell transplant that are questionable, meaning that they'd be happy to transplant you, but they'll also charge you an arm and a leg. And you want to make sure that their safety protocol is good, with a very low mortality rate, low complication rate, and that they have a good protocol that's been established that is shown to be effective. Otherwise, I think you're putting yourself at risk greatly for major complications, and if the protocol isn't done in a very rigorous manner, you may not get any benefit. So it's definitely an option. We usually reserve it for people who failed everything, failed all manners of therapy, even off-label therapies, and they're still rapidly declining, and they're still young, they're still highly relapsing. Those are the people we refer to academic centers like UW for relapses. And most protocols have a requirement that you failed one or two drugs, that you have X number of relapses in a certain period of time to actually warrant it. But definitely effective, but not yet a cure. But we're starting to understand it better, and it's definitely, I think, within 10 years of potentially being offered as a standard treatment. And the other drug I'm not familiar with, is this a drug? So is our caller off the line? Yeah. Anyway, so I'll just take the next caller unless that patient is able to, that caller is able to clarify.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Are you still there?
Yeah. My microphone was
no, that's
swung
okay.
The other way.
Did you hear my...
Anti-lingo. Yes, I did, and thank you so much for the discussion of stem cells. A researcher found what she got to call lingo, which is something that prevents the oligodendrocytes from reforming myelin, and the company that she works for, which manufactures one of the interferons, is working on an anti-lingo, which in layman's terms would tell the body to stop telling the body to not make myelin.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's actually pro, like, regenerative, promoting the formation of myelin. Yeah, and that's a huge area of research. Again, I don't know anything about that drug. There's so many drugs that are in research and development, and these are the kind of the compounds that are being studied, many different cytokines, many different compounds. And I think, to answer your question, I think if you were to go back to the original researcher and look at the primary kind of literature behind it, find out, you can simply call the institution. That's probably the best, the most direct way. Most places, actually, you know, you can call and find out more information about how to join the study. And most things that are being studied at this stage, they're actually still not even made it to phase 1 clinical trials, meaning that they're in the process of doing phase 1 clinical trials. There's a strong possibility that you'd be able to enroll if you qualify, but the problem is this distance. So most of the medications that I follow, since I left the University of Washington, I'm more in community practice, most of the medications that I follow are the ones that are being pushed through phase 2 to phase 3 clinical trials that I know are about to be submitted to the FDA, and those are the ones I keep track of because those are the ones that are going to be hitting the market that I want to know everything about so that I can make it available for my patients. The other things that you're probably best going to an academic center, it's at the source, because even an academic center, MS center, may not actually follow, you know, all of these thousands of compounds that are being studied. But I will say that regenerative substances are being studied, and oligodendrocytes are the cells that are responsible for remyelination and repair after an MS attack. Those are cells that actually are the support cells that remyelinate. And so targeting those cells is actually totally a huge area of research. This drug and many, many others are looking at that pathway, and it's very promising. And I think that the problem is it's not available, but it's definitely one to follow. And if it's probably, my guess is, in phase one clinical trials. You can call and see if you can participate, but just keep looking and listening for these compounds to actually be pushed through phase two, phase three. So just really briefly, a medicine, it's born in a lab somewhere. Someone has a bright idea and designs a drug or stumbles upon it. It has to be cleared through animal studies for safety. Then they go to humans, and that's called a phase one clinical trial. That usually is several months to a year, very small, usually less than 100 people. And it's just safe, just simply, is it safe? Are there signs that it's beneficial? If it clears that, then it goes to stage two clinical trials, and stage two clinical trial is where it's usually at one institution, much bigger, maybe several hundred patients or close to 1,000 patients. If it's, and again, they're adjusting the dosage for efficacy and adjusting the dosage to look at side effects. And then if it clears that and it's safe and it looks promising, then it goes to stage three. Stage three is where it's multi-center, placebo-controlled, and you have a protocol. It's uniform. It's well-designed. Multiple centers throughout the world and different continents will study it simultaneously in phase three trials. And that's, if that's cleared, that's when it gets to the FDA for approval, and it takes the FDA anywhere from 6 months to a year. And they may say no and require more data, or they may say yes, and then it's on the market. So for me, I think it's hard to keep up with all of the thousands of compounds that are in phase one or even in basic science. But that's what the internet is for, and I think it's good that patients look into these things. And our job as neurologists is to help them get to the source and actually find out more and potentially join a clinical trial. Just be aware that when you join a clinical trial, you may be put into the placebo group, meaning that you're giving an inert substance. That's kind of the risk that you take. But it's helpful for everyone because the results may actually change our options for therapy. So sorry I can't help you more on the lingo, but it sounds promising.
And there are currently no more questions in the queue, Dr. Levy.
Okay. Thank you. And I could, I will stay on the line for a little bit longer to answer any additional questions that roll in. Otherwise,
yes, ma'am. There is a pardon me for the interruption. There is a question from Sherry. Sherry, please go ahead.
Hi, Sherry.
Hello, doctor. My name is Sherry, and I was diagnosed in 1996 at Northwestern University Hospital by Dr. Bruce Cohen.
Yeah.
I'm 50 now, so I was diagnosed at 34, and when I came into the hospital, I could not walk or write anymore, and I think my first symptom was tinnitus. So when I went in there, I guess I had the 5 days of Solu-Medrol, and then he prescribed Avonex for me, and I immediately started the Avonex, and I'm living, well, that's in Chicago, but I live in California, and my primary care physician immediately put me on the Avonex injection. And I was on it for about 10 years.
Yeah.
My sister has MS, and she's 65. She's 15 years older than me.
Yeah.
And she's always had a case of benign. She's never been on medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, recently, her leg has been kind of dragging or something. I haven't seen her in a little while.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if medicine's an option at her age or what's going to happen there, but he's evaluating that.
Yeah.
But I stopped the medicine because I kind of got a needle problem.
Uh-huh.
And so I stopped the medicine. I'm not on it now, but I'm thinking that maybe I should go back on it because of the progression issue. All I have now is like numbness and tingling in my right hand,
mm-hmm.
and I still have that tinnitus. But otherwise, my exams, the MRIs have been good. I'm very active. I exercise a lot.
Yeah.
I'm in really good shape.
But you're noticing some progression.
But I'm worried about, yeah, I'm thinking maybe I should, you know, my insurance company covers it.
Right.
You know, I have a zero copay, and I'm thinking maybe I should just go back on it.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is something that a neurologist, and it's a tough question because you're at an age where you could be secondary progressive or just beginning the period of secondary progression. And I think that a good exam, looking at your scans, and again, it sounds like they've been stable, and then looking at your options for therapy and looking at the risks of them, is it a risk that you're willing to take, and is it tolerable, something you can live with, for the potential benefit? And that's the thing, is you're not having any relapses anymore. And so in terms of relapse reduction, that measure no longer applies to you. But it could potentially help with progression. And that's where we need more studies. And that's where Tremlett and this other paper in JAMA kind of came out. And you have to look at, I think, more and more at the nuances of these studies as to neuroprotection, benefit for disability, prevention. That's, I think, what we need to focus on, and we don't have the best data for that stage, for late secondary progressive or secondary progressive MS, and I think that's where it needs to be guided by a neurologist in a discussion, and you could always do a trial of a medication, and there's a lot of faith. You have to have faith that it is working, but there's no guarantee that it will. And I think it depends on what medical problems you have, and that's how, kind of what medications you choose depends on the efficacy, the side effects, and what the risks are and what the potential benefits are. And that's a really hard question to answer. But if you've noticed some change, that's where I think it could be looked at again. And then just as a side note, Avonex now has an auto injector available. That's new as of February. So the needle size has decreased. It's more in keeping with the interferon injections that are much smaller and shorter needle, but still in the muscle, but much shorter, and it's an auto-injector. You don't see the needle. So that's the newest thing on Avonex. And it's hard for me to take these individual questions and give people medical advice, which I really think is I shouldn't do, because I really need to know the full story and do an exam and really get into individual features before you can make blanket statements. So I think the best message really is talk to a neurologist, and if you can, at an MS center who's an MS specialist.
Okay, doctor, and there are no more questions.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation. This concludes your call, and you may all disconnect.